We're going to spend some time now with Masha Gessen. She's a Russian-American journalist who has reported extensively on the breakup of the Soviet Union, the Chechen Wars, and on LGBT issues in Russia. She's author of a number of bestsellers, including The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. And as a Russian-American, she is uniquely qualified to investigate the deeper backstory of the Tsarnaev family. And so she did. Traveling from Dagestan, Russia, and Chechnya, she traces the family's dislocation from Chechnya all the way to their arrival in Cambridge and then to the Boston bombings. Her new book describing that path is called The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. And Masha Gessen joins us today from San Francisco. Masha, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's really wonderful to have you. And I have to say, the book is an incredible read. There's so much to discuss, but I wonder if we might just sort of start with sort of your take on something that we saw just this week in federal court in Boston, because yesterday defense attorneys showed a picture pulled from, they say, Tamerlan Tsarnaev's computer that showed him dressed in white, holding a gun with a white flag behind him with Arabic writing on it. It seemed to imply radicalism or jihadism. The defense team didn't say where the photo was taken. I'm sure you've seen an image of it. And based on your reporting and your understanding of the story, when you saw that picture, when you see that picture, what do you think we're looking at?
Well, I don't think it should surprise us. First of all, we do know that Tamerlan Tsarnaev build bombs and set them off at the Boston Marathon. We also know that he was talking about this a long time before it happened. He was talking about it in Dagestan. He was also a sort of very much an actor, somebody who dressed in extravagant ways. He had various extravagant ways of dressing. There are pictures that the defense could have shown, except it wouldn't help the defense's case, of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, you know, wearing shirts unbuttoned to his belly button, and pointy shoes, and all of this glamorous wear that he referred to as European wear. He was a very flashy guy. And the thing is that a picture of Tamerlan Tsarnaev playing jihadi dress-up doesn't really tell us anything. Obviously, the defense is trying to show that he was the hardened criminal, he was the mastermind, he was the driving force, none of which is in doubt, actually.
Well, you, by virtue of being a Russian-American and being a courageous investigative journalist, you have through this book sort of a unique perspective here, and I'd love to sort of take some time to explore that, because you went to Dagestan recently, and this is a place that plays a central role in the story of the Tsarnaevs. Before we get to that, I'm wondering if you could just describe to us Dagestan as you saw it on your recent trip. I mean, I know you've told the Nieman Foundation that it was a place that was a little too scary for your taste right now.
It's absolutely the riskiest place in Russia right now to work as a journalist. It's when I was going there, I actually took a number of trips there while I was reporting the book. The last one was the most productive, and that's when I interviewed several of the people involved with Union of the Just, which is the organization that had been led by Magomed Kartashov, the person that the reporter was just referring to, whose testimony was used in court. And I'd like to return to that in a minute. But Dagestan is a place that has been in slow-burning warfare for the last more than a dozen years. And that means it's constant violence, it's constant killings in the streets, it's bombs going off, you know, every few days. It's federal troops in the streets constantly, on the lookout for young men whom they consider to be, basically all young urban men in Dagestan are considered to be terrorism suspects. Every few weeks, federal troops identify one of those men and lay siege to his house, and the man goes out in a blaze of gunfire. This is such a regular occurrence that it would be funny if we weren't talking about people's lives, because every time the federal troops claim to have annihilated, which is their preferred term, another leader of the Dagestan insurgency. And Dagestani journalists are certainly forgiven for doubting that the insurgency produces a leader and leaders on such a regular basis.
And yet this is the place that Tamerlan Tsarnaev went to in 2012. So in your investigation, I mean, what did you find that he did there? I mean, you mentioned the Union of the Just. Who did he meet? Who did he talk to? What kind of conversations was he having?
So a couple of things I'd like to say about that. The testimony that we were just talking about, Magomed Kartashov's testimony that was presented in court yesterday, that is testimony obtained from Kartashov when he was already in a Russian jail. He was arrested a few days after Tamerlan Tsarnaev was identified as the Boston Marathon bomber. And all the testimony obtained was obtained with the aid of Russian security services.
So you're calling it under question?
I am calling it into question. And I'm calling it into question for a couple of other reasons. One is that if Tamerlan Tsarnaev had wanted to join the jihad in Dagestan, opportunities were plentiful. There is the Dagestani insurgency, which is a real thing. There are undercover troops, guerrilla troops, hiding in the forests in Dagestan. Finding them does not present a problem. He was there for 6 months. He had plenty of opportunities to do that. At the same time, there was a major recruiting effort going on in Dagestan for people, for young men who wanted to go to Syria to fight. He had ample opportunity to join that effort. He didn't do that either. What he did there was he sat around talking with people. He sat around talking with his cousin Magomed Kartashov, who's actually, by Dagestani standards, a close relative. A second cousin is practically a member of your immediate family. And he was talking to other people that Kartashov introduced him to, especially to Kartashov's deputy, Magomed Gadzhiev, with whom he became very good friends. And I had many conversations with Gadzhiev, who, unlike Kartashov, is not in jail, and I think is something more of a reliable source. And basically, they certainly talked a radical line. They did not talk about terrorist action. They didn't talk about violent action. But they talked about establishing Sharia law around the world. They talked about the unfair treatment of Muslims at the hands of both the Russians and the Americans. They talked about the basic similarities between the United States and Russia in their treatment of Muslims. And all of this is directly related to the fact that the Union of the Just is an organization that is affiliated with Hizb ut-Tahrir. Hizb ut-Tahrir is the largest pan-Islamic organization in the world. It is an organization that publicly denounces violent action. It speaks out in favor of establishing Sharia law through peaceful means, through basically promoting the philosophy of the Quran. A lot of experts around the world and a lot of governments consider Hizb ut-Tahrir to be a gateway organization to more radical action. These things are not necessarily in contradiction.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, I mean, this is a central theme of your book, that you say that the United States has sort of fallen into what you call the radicalization narrative, and that, as you see it, that's not really an accurate way of looking at it, that formal radicalization didn't necessarily happen to Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And I guess what I'm wondering is, does it really matter that formal radicalization, a process, didn't occur while he was in Dagestan 2012? Because as I'm hearing you describe, like, he could have joined fighters who were going to Syria. There was talk about, you know, an Islamic state, about Sharia law, et cetera. And, you know, as we talk about, you know, terrorism being an ideology or a movement rather than a formal, you know, any one particular formal organization, isn't just those discussions that Tsarnaev may have had in 2012, isn't that enough?
It may very well have been enough for him. The problem with that is that it doesn't have any predictive value for terrorism policy, right? It's good enough for my story. I think it is I was able to sort of show what happened to Tamerlan and what his evolution was, but it doesn't tell us anything about possible future terrorists. We know at this point that radical beliefs are actually not a predictor of terrorist behavior. Most people who hold radical beliefs, including radical beliefs that that favor violent action, will never build a bomb. At the same time, we know that some terrorists actually don't hold radical beliefs or haven't held them for very long. A good example is the man who took hostages in a cafe in Sydney last December. This was somebody who'd been a criminal before, who was clearly a violent man. His radical beliefs seem to be sort of tacked on to just his latest crime.
You know, what seems so ironic to me is that you describe very clearly in the book that one of the reasons why Tsarnaev's family, you know, they basically, the story begins in Dagestan, then flows to Kyrgyzstan and Chechnya and back to Dagestan, but that they come to the United States from Dagestan because they are trying to, you know, escape what's happening in Dagestan. As you were describing earlier, basically a burgeoning war, a government crackdown against Muslims in response to rising radicalism in Chechnya. It feels so ironic to me that their arrival in the United States was predicated by a desire to save their son from a war in Dagestan that's being inflamed by a brand of Islamic radicalism.
Well, and their timing couldn't have been worse. I mean, they zigzagged around the former Soviet Union from the time that they met in the mid-1980s, the Tsarnaev parents, kept looking for a place where they could be at home and where they would be safe, where they could bring up their children. They were genuinely committed to giving their children an education and making good people out of them. And so they moved to Chechnya a few months before the war in Chechnya began. Then they moved back to Kyrgyzstan. Then they moved to Dagestan. And Dagestan and Kyrgyzstan sound alike, but they're 1,500 miles apart. Kyrgyzstan is in Central Asia. Dagestan is in the North Caucasus. So they moved to Dagestan just as the war in Chechnya spread to Dagestan and has since become a much bigger problem in Dagestan than it is in Chechnya currently. And then they finally moved to the United States and they managed to land here in early 2002, so a few months after 9/11, at the height of anti-Muslim sentiment, at the height of a kind of suspicion that is cast on Muslim immigrants, which has very real consequences for a lot of Chechens in the Boston area. Not that there are a lot of Chechens, but for the Chechens in the Boston area, because some of their refugee status was thrown into question and they saw this happening to their friends. So once again, they found themselves in the position of being suspect, of being other, and never having much hope of assimilating.
I'm speaking with Masha Gessen. Her new book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. It is the story, as Masha Gessen investigates and reports it, of the Tsarnaev family, not just of Tamerlan and Jahar Tsarnaev, but of their parents, of their grandparents, and of the long and painful history that led ultimately to the finish line at the Boston Marathon in 2013. She's joining us today from San Francisco. And listeners, if you have a question for Masha Gessen, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet or find us on Facebook at Radio Boston. Masha Gessen, before we leave Dagestan as a key place in the story of the Tsarnaevs, can you just describe to me what you do think Tamerlan Tsarnaev found there when he found there for himself when he went in 2012?
Right. So when I say that he wasn't necessarily radicalized in Dagestan, I'm not implying that he didn't have a radical experience in Dagestan. I think he did. It's just not what you might have thought it was. He went to Dagestan having lived in the United States for a decade, having never, not quite found his place. In fact, having had his hopes dashed. He had hoped to become an Olympic boxer. It wasn't a crazy dream. He was an extremely talented boxer. He was winning amateur competitions. Then one year, the Golden Gloves Association changed its rules and he was no longer able to compete in the nationals because he wasn't a U.S. citizen. He was just a permanent resident. So his hope for joining the Olympic team was dashed. And the same sort of thing happened to every member of the family. So he went back basically a lost boy. And what he found is something that may be familiar to anybody who lost who left their home as a child and then returned a decade later, which is an experience of radical belonging, of feeling at home, of feeling accepted. In his particular case, what made it very special was this recognition of a large community of young urban Muslim men who had been sort of made into illegals by Dagestani society and who, as a result, spent all their time sitting around talking about how they were both oppressed and radical and right. And so he fell right into that conversation. He felt very much like it was his conversation. He felt heard. He felt like an expert at times because he could talk about the United States. He's a good talker, and he was a very intelligent young man. So I think that that experience really changed his outlook and made it very difficult for him to return to the United States after 6 months in Dagestan and return to his life as a house husband. His wife was going out to work. She was working as a home health aide, backbreaking work. He was babysitting their toddler daughter. And there was the siren call of belonging with the smart, beautiful, radical young men he had met in Dagestan.
Right. So, I mean, even upon hearing this, though, I think that for many people, there's still a gap, though, between a sense of understanding of that feeling of dislocation and then a year later placing bombs at the finish line of the marathon. I mean, did you reach any greater understanding about how Tsarnaev himself traversed that gap?
You're absolutely right to use the word gap, and I think there's always a gap, because the experience I ultimately describe is not extraordinary. This kind of tragedy happens to immigrants all the time. What we do know is that terrorists usually come from the ranks of immigrants. They're usually young men, men in their 20s. They're usually educated, and they're educated in a secular way. They usually come from a middle-class background, but they have increasingly experienced marginalization. They're usually part of a very closed social circle, and all of their connections are formed in that social circle. But obviously what I'm describing applies to hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people around the Western world. And only a few of them will ever bridge the gap. And we don't have an explanation for that.
Now, there's so much history that flows through your book and, in a sense, flows through the Tsarnaev family itself. And I just want to take another brief minute to talk about a part of it which maybe not a lot of people know. I mean, because you take some time to discuss the story of Chechens themselves and what has happened to them over the past 60 or 70 years. I mean, the 1944 expulsion by Stalin of a 500,000 Chechens and the manner in which they were loaded into cattle cars and taken 2,000 miles into Central Asia, you know, and they were given, when they arrived, given rations that were less than those given to prisoners in Auschwitz. I mean, it's a sickening and horrific story. The Tsarnaev's father, or grandfather, I should say, was one of those people who arrived in Central Asia. Do we know how much of this story Jahar and Tamerlan knew, how much it informed how they saw themselves?
Oh, a lot. I mean, this is a central narrative for the Chechen people. It is absolutely essential to understanding the Chechen identity, which makes perfect sense. I mean, that's like... that's almost like saying how talking about somebody who is Jewish and asking how much the Holocaust informs their sense of themselves. It is huge. It looms enormous over the identity of any Chechen, and possibly even larger for the Tsarnaev brothers, who sort of started reclaiming and rediscovering their Chechen identity as teenagers or young men. We know that that was happening with Jahar as he was finishing high school and he was entering university. We know the same thing was happening to Tamerlan. And I went into detail about this history in the book, partly because it's such a huge part of Chechen identity, partly because it's a story that absolutely must be told. I mean, these deportations, the sort of the image of a million people, and it was more than a million people because it was not just Chechens and Ingush, but other ethnic groups from the Caucasus, being loaded onto cattle cars with no warm clothing, no food rations, sent for thousands of miles, This was happening in February and March 1944, so a few months before the world learned about the Nazi death camps. But the world never learned fully about the deportation of the people of the Caucasus under Stalin.
And I mean, it's not as if after the 40s and early 50s, things got much better because, of course, as Chechens were given a form of autonomy in the late 80s, in the 90s, the Chechen wars occur. And you actually, you know, reported extensively from that. But you also say clearly, you know, in the book that the Tsarnaev family itself, they were able to get out of Chechnya before that conflict really heats up. And you write that as a family, they never endured the ordeal to which virtually every family in Chechnya was subjected, that of searching and waiting for a male relative who had disappeared. So I'm wondering how much the conflict, the awful conflict in the 90s also, was part of Jahar and Tamerlan's consciousness.
Well, who's to say how much trauma constitutes real horrible trauma, right? We know that they were living in Kyrgyzstan with the dream, like a lot of Chechens who stayed in Central Asia. So after the deportation of 1944, Chechens were forced to live in Central Asia for a dozen years without the civil rights that were accorded even to regular Soviet citizens, which isn't a lot of rights. But they were essentially exiles, you know, with highly restricted freedom of movement, highly restricted rights to participate in the economic life of the society where they were living. It's basically highly restricted. After 1956, they were allowed to return to Chechnya, but not to reclaim their homes and not to reclaim their land. So of necessity, many people stayed. And the dream of returning to Chechnya someday was the central Chechen dream. So the Tsarnaev family, with three young children, this was before Jahar was born, went to Chechnya to finally fulfill that dream, to live in Chechnya, and Jahar was born there. And so a few months after he was born, war began to break out. They ran back to Kyrgyzstan in a gunshot-riddled car, and they drove across the vast expanse of the former Soviet Union to get back to Kyrgyzstan to save themselves. They arrived safe and secure. How are we to measure that trauma, the trauma of going to your dream home, thinking that you've finally arrived, and having to run away as bombs were falling on your homeland? Having to stuff your four young children into a car and drive for thousands of miles to save your hide. That's not, on the face of it, as bad as living through months and years of bombing. It's not as bad as losing one of your male relatives. It's still much, much worse than the trauma that most people in the Western world can even imagine.
So you can also then understand why so many people, upon hearing this, might feel uncomfortable with what I think you're claiming to be a central truth, that we cannot tell, you know, we cannot say, you know, whose trauma is worse, and we cannot tell how that trauma is transmitted through generations and how it might play out. I mean, it makes it seem... Let me back up, because in a different interview I read that you oftentimes during reporting the story, you kept thinking to yourself, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, and as you said earlier, tens of thousands of other people who may have experienced similar things. It just seems, it's a disturbing thought to think that, is it kind of random that some people go on to be award-winning journalists who speak truth to power such as yourself, and other people go on to become Tamerlan and Jahar Tsarnaev?
Right. So but for the grace of God is part of the, I think, part of my experience of reporting on their immigrant life. I was a teenage immigrant in Boston. I didn't experience my existence as precarious in Boston. But looking at what my family went through and looking at what their family went through, I see that the dividing line at some point is very, very thin. And it was something intangible, like a sense of intellectual entitlement that drove me and my younger brother to get a good education and become, both of us become award-winning journalists, and the Tsarnaevs to never quite make it. But I don't want it to come across as, I don't want to come across as saying, look, a bad immigrant experience is what makes terrorists. That's obviously not true. A bad immigrant experience makes unhappy people. Some of those unhappy people may become criminals of various kinds. And I think that's ultimately the biggest message that I want to convey, which is that we think of terrorism, because the threat of it is so huge, because the fear looms so large, we think of it as something almost superhuman, and that has to have a clear, grandiose, grand explanation. It doesn't. Like any crime, it actually is probably part of a small story, and I think we would benefit from thinking of terrorism as a crime.
But on the other hand, I mean, because there are so many people who have had similar life experiences like this, and yet so few of them go on to choose, you know, they experience their family's histories and their own histories like, you know, open wounds, and then choose to go on to wound others. It doesn't necessarily absolve the moral responsibility that we all have to choose a nonviolent path, does it? Does it not? This is not an explanation that you're offering, is it?
It may be an explanation. It's not a justification.
It's not, or an excuse. Okay.
Right. It is certainly not an excuse. It's, as I said, again, it's a crime, and it's a crime of murder. It's a heinous crime. I think that the only way we can hope to ever prevent crime, or at least to develop something approaching a sane and effective policy, is to view the criminals as human beings. That's the only way we can ever hope to understand what happened. The way that we view terrorists now is both subhuman and superhuman. And that's very much what happens in war. Every time you have a war, you portray your opponent as both less than human, and we see that happening in court right now, you know, where Tamerlan Tsarnaev is portrayed as a monster, as not exactly a human being, and at the same time possessed of superpowers, right? And I think that picture that you mentioned at the very beginning of him in a white suit against a white flag conveyed sort of both of those messages at the same time. That's not a human being we were looking at.
Really? I mean, intellectually, I understand what you're saying, but emotionally, I think many people do see him as a monster, whether or not he's human. He did a monstrous act.
He absolutely did a monstrous act. And maybe it's perfectly right for many people to see him as a monster. It is only important for people who make anti-terrorism policy, and I think for those of us who write about terrorism, to present a more complicated picture, because the simpler picture wasn't working.
Masha Gessen, before I let you go, there's one quick question I do want to ask you, because I heard a remarkable interview that you did with David Green on NPR's Morning Edition earlier this month. And in that interview, he mentioned that you had told him you might not take the new book and promote it too much in Boston. You're, of course, on Radio Boston right now. I'm just wondering, do you still feel that way?
Actually, I don't. The reaction in Boston has been amazing, which it's much better than I could hope for. And I just want to explain why I made that remark to David, actually, before we went on the air. And then he sort of ambushed me by asking me about it on air. But my conjecture is very simple. I know how painful this has been for Boston. I've spent a lot of time in Boston reporting this book. I have a lot of friends in Boston. I went to high school in Boston. So, and I was very aware of the fact that my not living in Boston at the time of the bombing and immediately after was a benefit for me in reporting the story, because I was far enough removed from it to not feel the brunt of the pain. I could sort of observe the pain from a slight remove. And I would not have been at all surprised if the book wasn't well received because of that pain.
Well, the book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. It's written by journalist Masha Gessen. Masha, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, let us know what you think. Send us your comments at radioboston.org. There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Doug Trabue. This is Radio Boston.